Everyone is talking about magnesium. It's all you hear about. But why? What do we know about magnesium? Well, magnesium is the number one mineral that 75% of Americans are deficient in. If you are a woman over 35, magnesium will help you rediscover balance, energy, and vitality. Magnesium supports more than 300 enzymatic reactions in your body, including those involved in hormonal balance. From functional medicine doctors to mental well-being and female hormone experts, we all know that magnesium is the one mineral to improve all aspects of well-being and health. But which one? Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, the trusted choice recommended by leading experts, with 7 best-absorbed forms of magnesium to ensure your body receives the support it needs for overall well-being. Go to bioptimizers.com/balance today and use code BALANCE10 for 10% off. Support your journey to wellness at bioptimizers.com/balance. Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, your foundation to optimal health and vitality.
Songwriter Soup.
I'm going to buy a really cool watch. Maybe I should do it for like 10 number ones.
Healthy recipes for not losing your mind and your money in the songwriter business.
And then I remember like 2 years later, I was like, I should have said 5. It's crazy to me that songs happen at all. I still think that, like, it's weird that this didn't exist and now it exists. It's a magical thing every time it happens.
Presented by American Songwriter.
Welcome to Songwriter Soup. I am Laura Veltz. My financial advisor, Tracy Hackney, and I got together a couple of years ago to write a book. The intention was to guide new songwriters in the career of songwriting, which can be very complicated and sort of mysterious because no one really tells you what to expect. And we thought we'd just dump all that in a book, which we did. Then we thought it would make for a really great podcast. So we made one. Then we decided to invite a bunch of our dear friends and colleagues to help explain from their perspectives what it's like to get through this career, like the beginnings and the middles and the ends. You're going to hear from a lot of those people throughout the season, but we are going to start it off with one of my dear friends, Jimmy Robbins. He and I have had hits together. Our families know each other. We're dear, dear friends. But he also has a really interesting story, which starts off with a lot of luck at face value, but really you don't know the backstory. And I didn't until we did this podcast. And it is just fascinating. I think you're going to love it.
So you guys know each other really well, and I don't know you super well. And so I'm pumped you're here. I appreciate it.
It's going to be a real treat for you.
We have Jimmy Robbins in today, and you know, I don't think we've told you anything about the book or the podcast, so that's good. You're coming in well prepared. Laura and I wrote this book together that basically takes the phases of a songwriter's career, which are day job, gets down. What's the next one, Laura?
Shitty deal
phase, and then first single or first cut, first single, multiple cuts, catalog sale, and legacy. So that sort of long-term songwriter's been in forever. So what we're thinking is, in this context, is kind of touching on those phases.
Sure.
With you and exploring from a creative side and how the money side affected you. You know, when you get to town, you have no money, or sell a catalog and things change, like how that affected you and positively, negatively, and that sort of thing. So that's sort of the format. Let's jump in.
Okay.
How'd you get to town?
Well, I got here. I got here probably about 10 years ago now. And there, for me, the path to Nashville started a long time before that. I started playing music when I was a kid and dropped out of high school to go on tour when I was 14. And toured for a couple of years just in a car doing that thing, and eventually put music on MySpace and Pure Volume, which were like the TikToks of their time.
Right. Those were big time.
And that turned into, I wound up selling, I think it was like 20 or 30,000 EPs myself. And that turned into signing to Motown Records when I was 17, 18. And then I sold about 20 or 30 records, which was pretty cool.
How much did it cost to make those records?
A lot more.
Right?
Yeah, my dad still, well, he did till he moved, but he would still get statements from Universal about how I owed them $800,000. And when I signed my first pub deal, the admin for it was Universal, and my dad was like, he was freaked out that the debt was going to carry over from my record deal, which it does not. It doesn't. So
that's
they can only recoup
right
off of that one record, and they're never going to. They will never make that money back.
Did you know that going in, like being such an entrepreneur early on, like having that, like selling those EPs on your own and then signing and doing the Motown record, were you thinking, oh man, it's on now? You know, what was the...
Well, I think I made a mistake that a lot of young artists make, which is like, I worked really hard, signed a record deal, and then expected them to make me famous. I was like, I got here, so this is definitely going to happen now. And the other issue, I now like encourage young artists to wait as long as they can on record deals, because I didn't realize just the shift in hoops you have to jump through to release music. And so I went from putting stuff out whenever I wanted to not putting music out for 2 years. And it just really stopped everything for me. And then also, I was young, and the manager I had at the time too, he was a great guy, but was also pretty inexperienced like me. And so we just sort of let the label steer us. You know, at the time I had swoopy hair, which has returned to my head during quarantine. But like I looked a certain way. I hadn't discovered beer yet, so I was much thinner. And they just kind of were like, hey, you look like all these kids in High School Musical. We should do that.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I was, at the time, I was doing like pretty dramatic, poetic emo music. And then didn't put anything out for like 2 years. And then when I did put music out, it was very Disney oriented. And I kind of lost the fans that I did have.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a perfect storm of badness, which is the name of my memoir.
Perfect storm of badness.
But so I basically asked out of that record deal because I was so unhappy with it. And at the time, that was my first taste of, I had never co-written until I got a record deal. I had been writing everything myself. And they started sending me around to all the big writers. And I didn't know that that was a thing, because all the records I grew up listening to were band records. So I would look at the liner notes, but they were being written by the band, or the band plus the producer. And so a part of me asking out of that deal was to try to be a writer, because that was the part I always liked. And I sort of sang my songs out of necessity, just because I didn't know somebody else would sing them. So when I got out of that deal, I moved to LA to try to write for Disney shows and stuff like that, because those were the connections I had made through the music that I had made. And that didn't ever pan out. I got a couple of close calls while I was out there. Had a Hannah Montana song that never came out that would have like really allowed me to stay. But basically I ran out of money, and I was living off of the advance. I got like $60,000 that I made last 4 years, and then hit zero, and moved here because my brother-in-law had apartments and was able to help me if I helped like cut grass and tear out carpets and stuff for the apartments. And then that was when I got here.
What I find really fascinating is how that pivots from this point. This is like an amazing backstory. Obviously, your story could easily be a book if you're thinking of a memoir. I remember that title you mentioned earlier. But like this point is, I think, where Jimmy defies a little bit of the normal trajectory of a songwriter. It's right after, like right at the point in the story you're talking about. So I'm curious, yeah. Will you go on? Go from here to like when... things started gelling.
Yeah, and that was very fast. I moved to Nashville and basically within 6 months got my first deal, and in less than 6 months of that had my first number one. So my very first cut that I ever got, well, I'll start. I moved here and tried to get a pub deal. So I basically made an EP when I moved here with the intention of just like having something to show people. And I had just enough money to buy the Pro Tools starter kit. it was like $400. So I bought the Pro Tools starter kit and made an EP. Like, I just learned it over the weekend and made an EP. And what that, I showed that to people, and everybody said no, the people I was able to meet with. But two important people I met were, was Josh Van Valkenburg at, it was EMI at the time. That was, he was so important because he introduced me to two people, one being Leanne Phelan, who wound up managing me for several years and helping to navigate a bunch of that. And the other person was John Knight, who John at the time was like having, he was in the first singles kind of phase that you guys talked about. He had a song on the radio, and it just became such an important songwriting relationship for me. But then the first person Leanne Phelan introduced me to, and this was all over the course of like a week that all I met all those people. Leanne played the EP that I had made for Joe Fisher, and Joe sent a song to Keith Urban, and it was a song I'd written by myself, and Keith cut it, or wanted to cut it, but also then played him another song that I had just written the day before with John Knight. And it was a song called Whatever She's Got. And Keith wanted to cut that too. And then they offered me a publishing deal that day. And they didn't have anybody else. They were like starting a company together to sign. And I was their first signing. And I think I signed that publishing deal the following like Monday.
I feel like every time I'm talking to young songwriters, you are the thing that sticks out in the exception. Yeah. Every time I'm saying like, you know, please be patient, it might take a really long time. It doesn't always happen the Jimmy Robbins way. You know, like you never know what's going to happen, but you are like the exception. But like Jimmy said, he earned it in this other way that, you know, nobody gets in with nothing. You have to understand the like challenges of the process of finding your way into the music industry. But I love his story because it's so, it like miracles do happen kind of a thing upon arrival. It does exist, you know.
And what age, so you start, you at 17, you were playing and recording music, making music,
but 14 was when I, you know, my dad's, when I dropped out of school, he kind of said, you're making adult decisions, so you have adult responsibilities now. And I kind of, you know, he wouldn't have let me be homeless or anything, but starting at about 14, it was like, figure it out yourself and monetize this in a way that you can live your life. Right. And so that's what I started doing. I remember there was a year where I didn't have money, but I had this online thing and I wanted to buy Christmas presents. So I sent out a message to the people that followed me and I was like, hey, for $100, I will write and record you a song with your name in it and facts about you. And I did like 15 of them and over a weekend and bought everybody Christmas presents.
This is something Jimmy does all the time. I get ringtones that have my name in them.
Well, when you've got a gift, Laura, you have to nurture it.
Everyone in town has an MP3 floating around somewhere that Jimmy produced up. And it is a signature little experience. Mine goes, Laura Fels, Laura Fels, and has harmonies. It's crazy. It was like potential ringtone.
That's amazing. Well, I think the point I was making is like you started at 14.
Yeah.
And then you were, when you got signed your deal here, what age were you then?
I think I was probably 22.
Yeah.
I think.
So still an 8-year trajectory. Yeah. You just started way early.
Yeah.
Yeah. Still a long haul, and the side hustles, you know, cutting grass.
There were many side hustles.
And making ringtones.
How long did you have to mow the grass? Like, how long were you in that house of your, I think you said your brother-in-law?
In that apartment? Probably 5 months.
Okay. Did you end up doing any carpet ripping and grass mowing?
I did, much. Okay. And I actually, like, cleaned and painted an apartment above mine where somebody had shot themselves in the leg. Oh,
your
and
story.
There was blood.
That is awesome.
Oh.
It was pretty gnarly. I ripped out pretty gnarly carpet too that had like flea infested whole thing.
Man.
And it was, none of it was fun.
That's putting in some some work.
Yes.
The day job phase for you is such an interesting, you're the chapter is almost so short, I might not even.
Yeah, that was like the only time.
It was so short.
Because before that, the only other time I worked was when I was 15. I worked at Target for like 2 or 3 months to save up enough money for a tour that we were doing. Because we weren't making enough for the gas to get from show to show. And the, I remember the way that I quit was that I never came back.
That's a good way to do it.
Yeah. Sounds like me.
Something about Jimmy that I've always found fascinating is he's such a likable human being. I think that contributes a ton to how quickly, I mean, you're just, and I, you know, whatever. You're just a very pleasant energy, which, you know, you kind of have to be a songwriter in this town. You kind of have to be a decent hang.
Yeah.
But when someone is like just a joy, I feel like that puts you faster on the faster on the road. Don't you agree?
No, I would argue being fun is as important, if not more important than being good.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Like there are probably, you would probably echo this. Like there are very talented, successful writers that I'm not interested in writing with again.
Mm-hmm.
And
on the counter side, there are
not,
really fun that aren't that good.
That I'll do it.
But I'll do it because they're so fun.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Isn't that wild? Yeah.
I'm right here, Laura.
Oh, God. Well, because the bartending phase is so strange, the day job phase, like maybe we skip to your deal and try to kind of unfold.
Yeah.
Obviously, you were offered a deal so quickly, but the deal points, did you understand what you were signing?
No. And I will speak a little bit candidly about it. It was like a pretty crappy deal.
Mm-hmm. That's the name of the chapter.
Yeah. So shitty deal.
This is everyone, but.
Yeah. And I mean, I am a publisher now, and I do get why the deals look the way that they do. It's very difficult to make money back in publishing and takes years, really. So I get all of it now. But it was the standard deal. It was like a $23,000 deal or something.
And did you own any of your publishing?
No. And I'll get into that too. I actually, so fast forward, I signed that deal. The first cut that I get is Sure Be Cool If You Did for Blake Shelton, which got cut and then was his single like 3 or 4 weeks after it was cut, was on the radio, and then like 3 months after that was number one. So that
can
was,
you imagine,
so like they recouped on me off of that song for like, you know, with whatever 9 months after that, the first quarter that they saw money from that probably recouped my deal,
right?
And I've got to tell the middle bits and stuff too, but fast forward to the end of that deal, I had never received CoPub and they had never raised my draw. It went up like $2,000 a year, and I wound up having like 5 number ones in that 3-year deal. Plus I got 100 major label cuts in those 3 years. And in addition to the 5 number ones, it was something like 13 or 14 Billboard entries, you know, so that's like top 10s and 15s too.
So you had multiple hits in your shitty deal phase.
Yes, which is very unusual.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again,
yeah.
You are the exception. Every time, it's a bizarre story and amazing.
But I learned a lot as a publisher. Like, if I were them in hindsight, and they're my friends, you know, I feel like I could tell this portion. Like, I would have come to me after that first year, or even during the first year, and been like, we should change this. Let's renegotiate this a little bit and just like to do it. But they never did that. And so then I played very hardball at the end of the deal. I was like, I'm going to just, like, by the third year, they kind of tried to. And I was like, no, I'm going to just run this out now.
As you're as you're going through your publisher hat phase of your life, do you find it to be a benefit to you that a songwriter doesn't know what they're signing? Or are you an educator? Like, how do you handle that?
The second one.
Okay.
We do different deals than I have signed. Like, we are very writer friendly. We put CoPub into first time deals.
Incredible.
That benefits everybody, really. It helps with recoupment. But yeah, like we try to make them very writer friendly because at the heart of it, I'm a songwriter.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not really interested in screwing over people. It's for us, the whole goal is to nurture talent.
I think without saying it, I'll say it. I think that there are lots of publishers who like their writers to be uneducated, which is a lot of why we are doing a lot of what we're doing, Tracy and I.
Like, yeah.
I feel like that's not cool, and education is power in every scenario. And I feel like, you know, it would be cool if the next generation, like you're doing with your writers, which I applaud you, like how wonderful that they have someone guiding them, because it sucks to get 4 years in and be like, hey, wait a minute. It sucks. Yeah. You know, it's like you're, oh, somebody took advantage of me. And then there is that icky feeling, which, you know, you don't want in a town this tiny.
Yeah. And with the way the market is changing to being such a sales thing where catalog sales and all of that, that's really the business now. Mm-hmm. And it's like you get to the end of it and you don't own anything. You're like, well, I had these hits. I'm going to do a flip. Oh, wait, shoot. No.
Yeah, I don't have those hits.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From a publisher standpoint, I think, how do you view that partnership when a writer signs to you and however much co-pub? Or to me, I think one of the things, I think you make the point maybe in the book of, you know, realize that they are going to, they do need to get paid. The publisher does need to get paid because they are taking a risk on that young artist and developing them. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you view or think through when you sign a writer, okay, here's how the deal is going to look. How much are we going to invest and that sort of thing? Just maybe play out a scenario.
Yeah, we're not a company that can go out and sign somebody and give them $100,000 because we want to, you know, like a brand new writer. But we do try to pay more than those like $20,000 deals and livable money. We go into it I think most publishers feel this way, but go into it knowing realistically 3 years would be on the early side to start making your money back. So I know that I'm going to be paying you and putting my energy into you and not get anything out of it financially. And I think you have to go into it knowing that. But the biggest thing for us when doing deals is like, we really want to like the people. Like, I need to want to see you win, because I like you and care about you, especially because a big part of what I can offer, like my wife runs our company and she's an incredible publisher. I can't really help with that part of it. I can help you write songs and I can help to get you in certain rooms and stuff like that. It's important that, like we were saying, like if you don't like somebody, you don't really want to go write with them very much. It is a business, but we still do it more like on a human level. And I think there are other companies that work that way too.
There are. I hope that they all are at some point here. Mm-hmm. Like a nurturer, you know? I feel like that's something I found in Mike Molinar and, you know, you're providing for your writers. And it's not because, you know, we're all children and we're looking for our long-lost parents. I think it's more because being a songwriter is a vulnerable thing to be. Mm-hmm. And you don't come in, you know, understanding how to manage money or understanding how to read a document that's, you know, lawyer jargon.
Yeah.
And your publisher is really going to be the person, at least in this town. You have writer managers in other towns, but here it's like, that's all you really have right off the bat is this person that's just guiding you. And I'm grateful for the town.
Yeah.
That there's a company like yours and then that there are, because you're right, there are many.
Yeah. But I think what you said is true, that there's a lot of publishers that like writers to not know. Because, I mean, those deals are not good.
They're shitty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is standard.
Yep. Mine was shitty. Yours was shitty.
But it is hard as a publisher. I also see, like, it's so difficult to make your money back. I understand why they're crappy deals.
Mm-hmm. But then when you do.
Especially in the streaming world that we live in now, where, like, that's so hard. We got 100 million streams. We made $11.
Yeah, it's definitely an ordeal, but we'll work it out as we go forward. Music industry will evolve. I'm so grateful when there is like the heart of just being a fellow human at the base of it. Like,
yes,
let's go forward with that. But moving forward, your bass hit collides immediately with your multi-hit, another unusual part of you.
Yeah, that very first year, I got a triple play.
Insane.
The first year of that pub deal.
Insane. And I remember this. I was in town wondering who the hell you were, because I was just like, who's this person who just came in and started, you know, just.
Well, and that was sort of at the birth of, I'm doing air quotes, it's a podcast, so you don't know that. but like track guy, right? The term track guy, I was one of a handful of guys doing that. The irony is that I had bought Pro Tools like literally 4 months before that, and was convinced that everybody was going to figure out that I didn't know what I was doing, especially when they started asking me to like produce records. and I had no idea what I was doing. I still feel that way about everything. Like I told Laura, this is the first podcast I've ever said yes to doing, because I, in my head, I'm like, if I do a podcast, people are going to figure out that I don't know what I'm doing. And like, that's just like my own, that's at the heart of me. Like, that's my whole deal.
Weirdly, I think maybe that's a sort of the nature of
songwriters.
I think we all have imposter syndrome. I think we're all like, when are they going to figure us out?
I don't think it's limited to songwriters. I go through my day. I go through my day thinking, oh my goodness, people are going to realize I really don't know what I'm doing. You know, when even, you know, you get the, I get the question, what's the market going to do? I don't know.
It's going to go up.
Or whatever, you know.
What a unifying thing.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
If we all feel that, then no one should feel left out, which is an ironic thing in that moment. But
I think being vulnerable about it is a beautiful thing.
Agreed.
You know. And
so you had 5 hits in your first year. Is that stretching it?
No, like first 18 months.
18 months and 3, you had a triple play on your first pub deal.
Yeah.
An insane feat. What was it like after? This is about when I met you. Your post multiple hit little bit of a dip phase was when I met you.
Yeah. I had like 2 insane years. It was probably like 2013, 2014. And then I remember 2015 not getting a number one song that year, and what that would being very difficult for me. I remember the first song I had to like fall off, like go to like 17 or something. It was a Sarah Evans song. And at that point, all I had known was number one songs, because I had gotten 5 singles and they all went to number one. And then I had like 5 or 6 things, you know, still do something like be a top 30 song, which prior to those number ones would have blown my mind.
Right.
But my perspective had changed so much, and my expectations, it was a really hard thing for me, very humbling, like stuff was not working. And I was very down. Like that was probably 2015, I think.
I feel like that is maybe exactly when I met you.
Yeah.
I met you in a at Douglas Corner. I don't even know if I was doing the round or you were, and I was in attendance, but we were not in the round together. One of us was just in attendance.
I almost don't think either of us were in the round.
No, maybe. Maybe we were both.
I think we were seeing somebody.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah, you're right.
I almost think it was it a Scott Stepakoff?
That sounds
and Josh
about
Osborne
right.
thing.
That sounds about right. Yeah.
And we were just there.
We were just there. I just remember like immediately knowing you were going through something.
Yeah.
You were talking and I was just like, this is a boy going through a lot. And you're younger than me. And there was a little bit of like big sister syndrome where I was just like, I think this man needs a hug. I don't know you, but
yeah.
I think we may have hugged.
Well, it coincided to my bad writing year with a bad life year. There was a relationship and an engagement that like didn't pan out. That all kind of happened at the same time too, which is sort of funny. Like that kind of makes sense that it would all happen at the same time. Stuff is always all good and all bad at the same time. So yeah, it was really hard for me. It's funny. We just had a conversation where I now feel that certain writers could use a bad year.
Mm-hmm.
Like it can realign your perspective a little bit if you're getting a little big for your britches or just like jaded and a little, I don't know, bitter about the whole industry. Cause I came out on the other side of it excited again. Mm. And then, you know, sort of like the way things do, it got better and more hits came. And it's like they talk about you get waves as a writer. And if you're strong and you stay in it, you'll get another one. And like, that's the whole deal is just riding it. Unless you're Ashley Gorley. And then it's
the
just
wave never stops.
It's like one of those wave pools where you could surf forever.
That's a great analogy. I have to say too, just as a human kind of connection, that would break a lot of people. Having that much success and then having it ripped out in this way. Of course, it seems snotty to even say, like, I had, you know, a top 30 is whatever, disappointing, but I completely, wholeheartedly identify with the expectation issue there.
Yeah.
And we talk about expectations a ton in the book because it's the thing that breaks people. But to have that kind of, I mean, it reminds me of like news stories where someone's name is just like instantly trashed. And it's like, are they going to survive this yeah. turn? And you're not that your name was trashed. Everyone was literally like, you were the golden boy forever. No one thought, you know, but for yourself, I'm sure it was strange. And I think that's
you know
a
what
lot.
I learned though, is that people don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Like I remember that year and even like the following year was still a little slow. It was really like 2 years where things were still going on, but I just remember feeling so terrible. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I'm so unsuccessful. And I remember coming up to people and they would still be like, you're killing it, man.
Yeah.
Good. And it kind of coincided with Sarah and I starting JRM. And so people were seeing that and that was what they were latching on to. I think we were building a building or something too. And I just remember being like, oh, people don't know.
Yep.
Everybody's too busy. It's like that therapy term, the invisible crowd. Mm. Like people walk into a room assuming everybody's looking at them, but everybody's assuming that, so nobody's looking at anybody. They're all only thinking about themselves.
Wow. Yeah. That is and this town in a nutshell.
Yeah, it is.
That's humanity.
It's the writer thing for sure. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I'm like, they're so aware that I don't have a song on the charts right mm-hmm. now, but nobody knows.
What's funny too is how different LA is in this way. This is one of the most wonderful things about Nashville. They remember how much they love the song.
Mm-hmm.
They don't remember when it happened. As a community, I think in LA, they were like, that was last spring. You're done. You know, like they yeah. really kind of fire people a little more quickly or something happens there where they really like dump people and they have to then reinvent themselves a year later. And yeah. here it's like things hang. They hang and they only remember how much they love the song. It really it tells you a lot about values here.
Yeah.
Like the quality of the song really wins most of the time, you know, most.
Who was your, in that, I kind of want to go back to.
To my shitty years?
Yes, let's stay in this.
To my pain?
Let's stay in. No, really the 2013, 2014.
Okay.
Where things were just rocking.
Yeah, going crazy.
What was the perception among friends, family of kind of what was happening with you? One of the things we talk about is kind of this concept of like, you look, you know, when songs are going up the charts, it looks like, oh my gosh, he's the richest guy on the planet. Mm-hmm. You know, all of a
sure.
sudden. And it's really not necessarily that way.
No.
What was there? What was that experience like?
Well, I remember I had already had a couple of hits. And I wanted to propose to a girl who wanted an expensive ring. And I remember feeling very strange, but I had to go to ASCAP and ask them for an advance, like to give me some money so that I could afford a ring. Like, and you know, I was still living, in a lady's attic. yeah, but like a bunch of hits came out of that attic.
Right.
But yeah, the money didn't, and I remember my first like good quarter not being nearly what I was expecting either from talking to friends about what hits were worth. I, at the time, didn't understand that I didn't have Copub and how that could affect the number they're telling me versus my just writer share check.
Right.
I now have a much better understanding about money and all of that. But no, it wasn't until like 2 or 3 years in that I felt like I had a good bit of money going on.
Did you take 30% and put it somewhere? Were you a guy who knew that taxes cometh, or were you a guy who
didn't?
So
I've had a business manager since I was 17.
Because of the band.
Because of the record deal.
Oh, the record deal, yeah.
My manager encouraged me to get a business manager when I signed my deal. And then my business manager has stayed with me ever since. But it was like, I signed a record deal and they gave me 60 grand. And then he worked for me for free, like doing my taxes and helping me pay my cell phone bills and stuff until I was like 24. Like that's he never made money off of me again.
Yeah.
And he just stayed with me.
Kind.
Yeah. He's been a great guy. And like, so yeah, we're like 10 years in or beyond 10 years into it now. Because I'm 31. But yeah, he just stayed with me and continued helping me do things. And like, I don't know how to do things still, kind of because of that. I've only written 2 checks in my life.
But man, to have a person.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
The taxes thing. Yeah, when you start making money and that whole thing, like he always had me paying quarterly taxes. So I've never like hit tax day and not been able to afford my taxes.
Tracy was the one who helped me make sure, like Drunk Last Night came out and immediately I was like, what do I do? And so he was the person that set me straight so that I didn't get caught. But you know, and I know 1,000 people who end up getting audited or forget to pay their taxes, which I think is hilarious. But I do understand the mentality of it because you see this money and you're like, surely this is all mine.
Yeah.
Like, definitely this is mine. I made all of this. And then you just delete reality for a while because it's so otherworldly.
Especially if you had a regular job prior to this where they withhold money for taxes.
That, exactly.
You know, then that might not be something you're thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
But no,
crazy.
I never didn't pay my taxes.
That's good. And had a great person in your corner already.
Yeah.
To kind of set you up. Sounds like you've had really good at key moments, really great people in
yes,
your life.
I've been really lucky with that. And that goes into like my writing world too. You know, I have met amazing people who I continue to write. Like Laura and I have written consistently for probably 6 years or something. And
our batting average is bananas.
Yeah.
Like we just write well. We write quickly.
Yeah.
And on the first day we wrote was in Mexico. I went on that trip secretly. You were my main reason for going.
Really?
Yes. Because I met you earlier and I was like, we have a total, there's a friendship a coming. I knew we were going to be friends.
Yeah.
And I knew the type of songs you wrote. And I had known some people who wrote with you and they told me a little bit about how you work. And I was like, if you're going, you're going to bond with this guy. And luckily, like the night we got there, there was like this buffet thingy and we were all eating and we were just like, what if we wrote, we were like writing titles the day we hung out, the night we got there. And the next day.
Yeah, we talked about that Love You, Hate You, Miss You title there.
And that was maybe the first song we ever wrote.
Yeah, we wrote 3 songs that first day.
Five songs.
I was drunk at the end.
Yeah, and we were all drunk at the end. But we wrote 5 songs in one day. And I remember going, I must have a nose for like a bond.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there's been other people where I'm like, oh yeah, you know, like I, you know what I mean?
It's
like,
the pheromones.
It is. There's some like there's songwriter energy, like a bond that happens. Sure. It's a lot like falling in love, but different. And some people mix those things maybe accidentally. But for me, it is very similar. It's like a thing, and I just remember knowing like we're gonna write amazing shit together. In fact, I feel like the night before I was like we're gonna write 1,000,000 songs, and Ryan, who we wrote all the songs with, Ryan Hurd, was like, don't jinx it, Laura. Stop jinxing it. And I was like, no, I know.
Yeah.
I know.
Okay. Just as a non-songwriter, raising my hand. So you guys meet and your initial conversation is titles. Tell me about that. Share that some.
Well, I feel like as a writer, you kind of just start listening. You become a very active listener and pick up on somebody saying something that even if it's not a title, maybe your head goes, oh, but that's like this and this, and it starts to spin. And I mean, you can always tell you're hanging out with writers because they pull their phones out and write things down when you're talking and then never give you money for it. but I think, I mean, we are very active listeners.
Listeners, that's so well said.
And if we're watching a movie or something, I mean, we all grab lines, or Laura's house shopping and her realtor keeps saying, this house has good bones.
Mm-hmm, yeah. It's my stupid story I tell. I told it last night in another interview.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's true. I just listen to people. He listened, like we listen. I've never put it that way, but active listening is like a total, comes hand in hand with writing songs. But yeah, that first night we had a title. And I think it's because you came up and you were talking to Ryan, who you knew, you guys were older friends. Mm-hmm. You'd known each other. And I think Jimmy's so funny. He's always like joking and I think you were like, love you, hate you, miss you. Like you said something funny and we were like, ooh, let's write that.
Yeah.
And then it was song after song and we just got drunker and drunker. And I think at least 2 of those songs have been recorded.
Yeah, that Love You, Hate You, Miss You was a single for Levi when he was on.
And it was recorded twice because didn't it get recorded again? that same song?
Yeah.
By another artist? I don't know.
Yes. Anyway, yes, it did.
Can I go to the bad years?
Yes, please.
Back to the bad years just real quick. I was just thinking of, was there some support for you in that space? Like, who was your crew that kind of came and said, hey, like gave you the hug?
Yeah.
Like Laura said.
Well, it's funny. Like my writing circles didn't change. I continued writing with the same people. And like I said, I don't think anybody else was aware or as aware as I was that less was going on. Because I was still a dude with 5 number ones. But I remember I had had 5 and I was like, I'm going to buy a really cool watch. Maybe I should do it for like 10 number ones. And then I remember like 2 years later, I was like, I should have said 5. but just at the time, it seemed, I was like, sure, this is obviously going to just go forever. This is going to keep going. And then that didn't happen.
But, and then it did.
and then it bounced back. And now everything's good again. But yeah, my circle was still the same. It was Laura and John Knight, Nicole Gallion, Shane McAnally, and Josh Osborne. Kind of my world was still those people. And that kind of is still all, it's all the people I write with. I talk to people nowadays who are like, if I could just write with so-and-so, I would definitely get a hit. But like most of my first hits were with other people having first hits. Mm-hmm. Like I really encourage people to just write with your friends. And I mean, definitely write up if you can, but I don't really believe in that idea. Like I remember publishers saying that was the whole, you've got to write up. And that just like wasn't the thing for me. Like I learned so much about writing songs from Nicole. And she had never, her first number one was with me, and John's first number one was with me. And I learned so much from him too. So it's, and there's still, like I said, I write with the same people I always wrote with.
Yeah. And that's a major point that Laura makes in the book is find your crew and help each other get better.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I'm glad you.
I love that. And the writing up thing you just said, I feel like I talk about some of that in the book as well about how, yeah, it's going to happen. Someone's going to get interested in your potential and your publisher is going to call and be like, oh my God, you're not going to believe this, but Josh Osborne wants to write with you. This happened to me. And I remember going like, learn. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like go in as a student. If you write up, go in as a student. And if you know, magic strikes, good for you. But mm-hmm. if not, take what you're learning and apply it to bring it back to your friends, you know,
mm-hmm.
and teach them what you learned. Cause songwriting is so accumulative. Like it's something you learn day by day, hopefully forever. I feel like I learned things from Joy, that girl we wrote with. I learned something that day. She's a new artist and I'm like, oh my God, something new.
Yeah.
Add it to the pile. But I loved that. Like, yeah. And it is funny that publishers think that that's the aim. It's like, no, it's not.
Well, I feel like there's something magic in two things. First writes, I feel like I wind up with a lot of cuts from the first time I write with people.
Mm-hmm.
And then like 15th writes and beyond.
Right.
It's like that. But those like 10 in the middle or, you know, math, 14 in the middle, whatever. But like the first time something special happens a lot of times because there's so much vulnerability and like everybody's nervous and like a song happens and we're all amazed that a song happened. But then like really once you're deep in it with somebody, great songs start to consistently happen just because it's so safe. We were just talking about that with Marin the other day of like it's great to like be in this space where if the song is awesome, that's great. If it's not, it doesn't matter. We'll write another one. They're always awesome, but that's just because we're awesome. But I mean,
it's the
you
hang.
Probably agree though.
I do.
Like
a good day is better than a great song to me.
Yeah.
A good day. I'll
and
pick.
More likely a great song is from a good day.
Absolutely. But I think if you're in the beginning of your career, imagine you've just got to town and you haven't had the Jimmy Robbins luck and you're just slugging it out year after year. I feel like you will end up with a better songwriting career if you choose a good day over a great song. Because at that point, you don't even know what a great song is. You think a great song means writing with someone over your, over. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's not what that means. And to this day, I feel like Jimmy and I are pretty similar in this way where it's like my calendar is a reflection of my fun, mm-hmm. like how much fun I'm going to have. It has nothing to do with like opportunity. The opportunity is to have a good day.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's how good songs get written.
When you can kind of will that into existence. Mm-hmm. Like I rarely these days have a session where I don't know anyone. Like it is my preference to have a Laura or a John or, you know, in there with me. Just it takes some pressure off. But I'll still do them. And there, it's funny, I am as nervous for those as I was 10 years ago. Like that, it's crazy to me that songs happen at all. I still think that, like, it's weird that this didn't exist and now it exists. It's a magical thing every time it happens.
And that it's lucrative, but it also means things to people.
Yeah.
That's the weirdest
part. It'll touch them straight to the heart.
Yeah. And it could happen 20 years from now. It could happen in a year. But like,
you're creating something that's going to be around.
Yeah. It's very strange.
Yeah.
Very magical.
You know, for the good years, it's probably worth noting. I think a lot of it for me too had to do with my demos standing out. Because I was part of that track guy thing, and because I didn't know what I was doing and I didn't know how to make stuff sound like a band, my sounds were strange.
Huh.
You know, like it was a lot of claps and like stomps because those were the sounds that I had available to me.
That was the pack you downloaded.
Yeah. Yeah. No, a buddy gave me a sample library. My buddy Mike Shimshack gave me this big sample library, and that was on everything I was doing. When they would play 10 songs at a pitch meeting, there would be mine, which I would always try to make it a point, and I still actually do, to put something strange in every demo. Just they'd be like, what's that?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that had a lot to do with it. But I have gravitated towards writers who don't really lean into the fact that I am a track guy, you know, like,
because you're not. I mean, there are legitimate, and just for definition reasons, a track guy in my head is someone who faces the computer the entire time. And there are a ton of very successful songwriters who are really good at that one role. But Jimmy, that's just not you.
Well, I've got to say, I would go on the record as I don't like that. And I don't like it in country music. Like, I get it in pop music where the track is so important. It's as important, if not more important, than the song a lot of times in pop music. Here, songs will still get cut off of guitar vocals. So I don't love publishing going away a piece of it
mm-hmm.
for a dude throwing up an 808 and a hi-hat. You know what I mean? Like, I don't really like that personally.
And there are two schools of thought there here. The acceptance that pop music is infiltrating, and that component of songs is only getting bigger here.
Mm-hmm.
And I can say counter to that, this version of songwriting is only getting bigger there mm-hmm. too. So it's kind of cool. They're cross-pollinating in a way that's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But there are two schools of thought, and I haven't even figured out where I stand on it, because the ease of having someone working on something when I walk away is really nice. But the pain of going, that's not a song. Like,
right.
Production and lyrics, melodies, and chords, that's what a song, you know, I'm air quoting, like,
yeah.
You know, songs are, what is a song? Like, I'm curious, what do you think a song is?
Well, yeah, it's like you hear Desmond Child talk about it, and he's like, yeah, we used to have those guys too, and we called them arrangers, and they didn't get publishing.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know,
they got paid though.
Yeah.
So how, it's like, it's a weird squirrely whirly situation in demo town when you're making $23,000 a year.
But that's why publishers love track guys because mm-hmm. you're getting free demos. But I just feel if you're getting publishing, like, your chair should be turned around.
I agree.
Participate in the song. And I think a lot of producers feel insecure about that part, but it's like, the more you do it, your opinion does matter. And like, if you're production-minded, that can really contribute to the arc of the song.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Because it could weigh in on the fact that you're like, maybe you're going to be the dude in the room that was like, well, every phrase right now is landing on the one. If you think about it like a producer, melodically here, it would be nice if we came in on the one and.
Brilliant, yeah.
You know, let's change our rhythm here. And
it's that student mentality, I think, too. Like, I think that the track guys that piss top liners off are the ones who don't consider themselves a student in the room. They don't turn around and try to learn how to actually do the thing. And I feel like but a lot of those people fall off. Like, we just kind of get bored well, yeah. with not being able to have like a collaborative songwriting experience. So yeah. the track guys, which is a condescending term in a way. It's like,
it's kind of meant to be, I think. Yeah, like, I don't love it when people say that about me.
Producer.
Yeah.
A writer producer is the more respectful term.
But it's like, production is sort of fleeting. I think sounds change. Songs will always be songs.
Mm-hmm. Truth.
So I think producers do themselves a disservice to not lean into writing.
And if you're out there listening and you're a new songwriter, producer at Belmont or MTSU or something, turn around and maybe listen. Just listen and say, throw something out, even if it makes you nervous, just to know you are trying to write. Mm-hmm. I think those people are more valuable in the room anyway. Just, it's a collaborative experience. Mm-hmm. It's cool.
Let's talk about that transition from writer to writer-publisher mm-hmm. and sort of what made you want to do that, and how did you make the decision financially and sort of strategically?
I've always been interested in it. I like the idea of investing in people. And I felt like I was already kind of doing some of that just by meeting younger writers and, you know, trying to be involved in programs and stuff like that. But it was sort of a perfect storm for me, where my wife was a publisher at Big Yellow Dog at the time, and we didn't really like the competitive thing there, where it's like, I remember I was visiting her there in her office when I got the call that I got a Tim McGraw single that Big Yellow Dog thought they were getting.
Mm.
And it was a little like, blah. Mm-hmm. And and right. so, and at the time I was parting ways with my writer manager. And so Sarah and I just started talking. We were like, maybe we should just do something together and do that, like build our own thing. And so that was a big choice, because she'll not be getting paid anymore. And then in addition to her not getting paid, we're going to be spending money. But it wasn't like a long conversation. She and I have both always been people who like make decisions and just do it. There was this quote I've always loved, which was, leap in the net will appear.
Hmm.
You just do it. And I've talked to my dad about this a bunch. I have a habit of overstretching, expecting life to work out. And then it always has always worked out. Like, I just am like, yeah, this is probably too much right now, either financially or like time or whatever. And then it's always like, well, it'll be fine. Right. And then it's kind of fine.
It's like water seeks its own level. It's like everybody has their own equivalent of like a balanced life. And with Jimmy, I've noticed, you know, your balance is like bananas to me. I don't know how you do all the things that you do. Every time we have a write, he's already had, you know, a song meeting, a little mentor session with a writer. Then we write a song. Then he does the production on the song. Then you have a corporate gig. I'm always just like, I'm amazed. Like, my balances are different. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because as a new writer, whatever you hear first is at first going to be the expectation you put on yourself. And it's like, no, we are all very different. There are people who thrive when they're at or over capacity. And there are people who thrive when they have space and time. And figuring out how you like to do it is like, oh my God, it's so key in finding like your happy day, you know, and then songs to follow.
I wonder if that has something to do with, so are you and your dad really close? Sounds like.
We're very close.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a similar approach. Like, I've done things that my dad thought were insane. One was leaving Northwestern and coming here. And I just do it because I think it's the right thing to do. And I'm pretty confident it's going to work out. And mm-hmm. I wonder, like, you have a different background.
I know.
I'm seeing something here that, like, I know conversations with you, Laura, is like, you've got had a different experience, because I'm super close with my mm-hmm. dad. He is absolutely my mentor and best bud. And it's
different.
You have a different outlook. And those we talk about these sort of scripts in our heads mm-hmm. that tell us certain things about whether it's taking career risk or money or anything like that. And I think we've got to pay attention to those. Mm-hmm. And one of the reason we wrote this book that was so fun is that you are so eloquent about being open and speaking about it. And it's been so fun.
And this has been such a journey together with you and I. And then again, I'm hearing all the strings you're drawing between things, but I think that's kind of amazing. The best I have is to hope that I can provide that for my children so that they don't feel like Annette won't appear. Because it's a beautiful thought that you're like, yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, all of a sudden you're going. It's like I have so much more of like looking around the bend and going, okay, I'll do it. You know what I mean? Like I have to see the end before I, you know, it's not like success at the end. It's more like, will I be at peace at the end of this? Mm-hmm. And that's because of my childhood. We have very different upbringings. And when you have someone where you're like, well, if he is there to help me, your dad's like, or to even to ask a question, you know, you're going to do things differently. And so again, not everyone's going to have that. There's a lot of people like me with like really estranged relationships with parents and go to therapy, friends. But like, you know, if that's not the case, you're going to do this particular career differently.
And it's okay.
And it's totally okay. It ends well. It's fine.
And as a publisher, I've actually had to learn that I can't expect each of our writers to want to do as much as I do. And I think there were years where I maybe put too much on people of like, and I was always in my head, I was like, well, I'm not asking them to do anything I wouldn't do.
Right.
But I do recognize now that I am like my best version of myself when I'm very busy. And I think a lot of that has to do with not having time to overthink is a good thing for me. And that can translate into creative as well. Like if I'm working on production or something, I kind of do my best stuff when I'm just like making decisions quickly. And I'm like, that sounds cool. Mm-hmm. Let's do that. Mm-hmm. And it's like a random sound. And I had to learn that not every writer is the same or every producer. And I can't expect them to like do six doubles.
Yeah. And on the exact opposite front, I've had to learn that telling people to take space and calm down and all those things, it's going to be advice I will give forever, but it's not going to resonate with everyone. I mean, this mm-hmm. book is for people who, you know, we try to kind of jump around, but trying to figure out how to relax and enjoy your life is the whole, you know, point of the book. It's going to resonate with some, and hopefully there'll be some nuggets in there for people like you that just really like love to rev your engine. But we're all different.
Do you feel like it's hard to say no to things because of the fear of like, if I don't say yes, somebody else will say yes? And eventually they're going to stop asking me to do things. It's the nature of this business to have windows mm-hmm. of time.
You're right. I feel like I do everything I can to approach that from a, does this sound fun? Mm-hmm. Does this not sound fun? And I pretty much always say yes if it sounds fun. And I always say no if it sounds like a nightmare, even if it's a really fantastic opportunity.
Which, you're a very secure person.
No, I'm not. I feel like I'm deeply insecure, and this is how I keep myself balanced. If I don't choose those things, I will be unhappy, and then I won't like writing. Mm-hmm. And to me, writing is like, it's the tap I want to stay on. Mm-hmm. And if I do anything to spook it, I don't have fun. And if I don't have fun, then I'm in a bad mood, and then I'm a bad mother, and then I'm a shitty partner to my husband, and everything is connected to my ability to flow in my songwriting, which my therapist is like, yeah, that's you in a nutshell. So figure out how to make that balance. But I really try not to think about the whole, like, if I'm not there, someone else will be there. I always try to go like, I'm not meant to be there because it doesn't sound fun. Mm-hmm. But that's not everybody's method. For me, it's really because I am deeply insecure and I don't want to get off balance? You know, what is your approach on that? Do the demons speak loudly with the whole comparing?
Yeah. I guess the problem is too that a lot of it sounds fun to me. Like a lot of the opportunities coming my way right now are fun, especially because I have so many writers that I enjoy. I'm really enjoying production right now. And I think some of that is coming from feeling more confident. And like, the production part of me has always been my most insecure part. Like I've always felt like a writer, but then like from demos to records, I'm like, that's the part where I'm still like, well, I just bought Pro Tools the other day. But I'm feeling better about all of that lately.
This has been amazing, by the way. You're
amazing.
Delight to talk to you, and I love you. But I want to know, you know, we don't know when we're going to die. You could die today. You could die tomorrow. Who knows? But the day after you die, whether it's tomorrow or when...
I feel like you're really telling me something here.
I want you to think about it from a, not necessarily you're an old guy. Like sure. You don't know when.
Yeah.
None of us know when. The day after, you know, the songwriting community is going to be at losers. Like, you know, we're all going to be somewhere going, what the fuck just happened? We just lost one of the greats. What do you hope we say?
That's very interesting. I actually think about my funeral all the time.
I do too. This is why
I think about, I have this fear of it being tiny.
You know, I have the same. I think the same thing. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like no one really cared.
Yeah. That's interesting. I hope people say I was, in the songwriting community, I hope people say I was good. You know, we've talked before about, like, this has kind of shifted now because you and I are having a moment with a song, but I felt really like, insecure and kind of jealous of other people's arc because we would both have big songs, but they would have the kind of big songs that it seemed like people would talk about and made an impact on people. And I was worried that so many of mine were fluffy and like were big and helped me get a nice house, but like maybe didn't worry about a girl at a bar or something. So, I mean, I guess I hope that the community would say I was good and a part of songs that mattered to them. I hope people would say I wasn't a gross guy. I hope I would be missed. And you'd miss me.
I'd miss you.
I hope it's not tomorrow.
It's not tomorrow. I like the discomfort of thinking it could be. Yeah. Because it helps me really distill what I want to leave. Like we talk about legacy more as a... you know, a conscious decision, like, what do you want in the book anyway, like, how will I set up my kids? How will I make them philanthropic minded? How, like, those kinds of things are where we go. But man, your legacy really comes down to that one conversation that all of your friends are having the day after. I mean, I think about Busby and Dorf. Like, we all got together and everyone said the same set of things. And it hit me that I'm going to have a set of things. What are they going to be? And I was curious, and I plan to ask this question to everyone we do this with, because so far they're different, you know?
Yeah.
They really are. Well, Jimmy, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you guys.
It has been a joy. This has been so fun.
I feel like I've talked
a lot.
I had no
idea.
No, that's what we wanted. It's wonderful to hear your story, and I'm grateful you said yes, because I know, like, you haven't said yes to this kind of a thing before, but I think this is going to be really helpful to human beings of all trajectories and kinds, songwriters and otherwise. So thank you.
Yeah. You said some stuff in this episode that is like so in line just philosophically with what we've always thought. And it's such, for me, it's affirmation of like, oh,
right, we're on the right track. Yeah.
So I think it's going to be really helpful to a bunch of folks.
Awesome.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks.
And they'll never know I didn't have pants on.
All right, y'all. That will do it for this week. Big thank you to our guest, Jimmy Robbins. If you like what you heard, stick around. We have so much more great stuff coming. In the meantime, subscribe, rate, comment, and share this with someone who might find this stuff helpful. Big thank you to American Songwriter. We'll see you next week.
All Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.